From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. She was outlandish, self-confident, and she slept in a coffin. Sarah Bernhardt was a household name in the 19th century, a stage actor who flaunted her independence and charmed the media, but was quick to sue publications when they wrote something she didn't like, and they often wrote things that she didn't like. She personified the dramatic celebrity who wrote a playbook for superstars who came after her. Now, media technology has changed since Bernhardt's day, with the internet giving fans direct and constant access to the superstars they admire, but the culture of celebrity has not. So this hour on Point, the drama of celebrity, and you can join us. Who gets to decide who gets to be a star? And what's your thought that a 19th century stage actor or, say, romantic era bad boy poets, that they crafted the original templates for how to be a celebrity? And what about us? What's our role as fans here in perpetuating a culture of celebrity? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us today from New York is Sharon Marcus. She's professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, and her latest book is The Drama of Celebrity. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Professor Marcus, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me here.
It's really great to have you. So, Sarah Bernhardt, I will admit that this is not someone that I knew anything about before reading your book, and she seems to be quite a unique person in the 19th century. So, let's just spend some time talking about her specifically. When did she first sort of emerge into the public consciousness?
Well, she was born in 1844, and she became famous pretty young. So by the 1860s, newspapers were writing about her conflicts with her stage managers and how they were firing her for insubordination. You are not alone in not having heard of her. I worked on this book for a while before publishing it, and the most common question I would get was, oh, right, Sandra Bernhardt. She was Madonna's girlfriend for a while. So I would then say, yes, Sandra Bernhardt's great, but Sarah Bernhardt, even better. She was someone who was a great performer and a great personality and a great showwoman. So if you took someone like Meryl Streep with her acting chops and someone like Cardi B with her flamboyance and someone like Ryan Murphy with his talent for knowing what the public wants and how to package it and rolled that person into one, you would have Sarah Bernhardt. Mm. She was classically trained in France when France was the theater capital of the world and theater was the main way that people got their entertainment. But she also knew how to use new media. She had herself photographed at a very young age, and often everywhere she went in the world, she would visit the leading photographers and have her picture taken. She had her voice recorded by Thomas Edison when that technology was new. She made films at a very advanced age when most people on stage weren't really learning new tricks. She made dozens of films.
Wow. So let's before we get to sort of how she very intelligently and cannily used the media of her time, but tell me a little bit more about her younger years, right? Because it came from a Dutch Jewish family, is that right?
So no one ever found out who her father was. Her mother was a courtesan, and Sarah Bernhardt never knew who her father was. She struck out on her own pretty young, didn't get along very well with her mother. Her mother was Jewish. Her mother was a Dutch Jewish woman who came to Paris to make a living. And Sarah Bernhardt very quickly established herself as a powerful and interesting actress who took on unusual roles. In her 20s, she made a big sensation when she was in a play that was about a Vestal Virgin. And rather than play the young, beautiful virgin, she asked to play the blind grandmother who has to kill her granddaughter when she loses her purity. And she became famous for going on stage and having only the whites of her eyes show for hours and figuring out how to stab her granddaughter even though she was blind on stage. So she would choose unconventional roles. She had an unconventional appearance. Today, people might find this hard to believe, but she was actually criticized for being too thin.
Right. So let's talk about that a lot in depth, because as I read the chapter of your book where you discuss the media's criticism of her and her body in the 19th century. It was actually pretty shocking, right? I mean, she was really raked over the coals quite a bit for her extremely slender physique.
So the constant factor here is women are raked over the coals for how they look. The part that's bizarre to us now is that she was lampooned viciously for being too skinny. At the time, the ideal of beauty really was to be very buxom and curvy. She wasn't, and she dared to present herself in romantic roles, in fashionable clothes. She did play that role of the blind grandmother, but often she played tragic, melodramatic women who sacrificed everything for love or who were femme fatales. And yet she didn't look the part of a conventionally beautiful woman, and she didn't care that she didn't look the part. And journalists were very hostile to her indifference to public opinion. And that was always part of her star persona, defiance, not caring. She also looked very visibly Jewish, so she didn't have the kind of typically French white woman appearance of the time. I mean, she was a white woman, but she had very curly hair. She had a kind of prominent, somewhat crooked nose. And rather than try to hide any of these things, she would wear tight dresses that showed how skinny she was, have herself painted in profile to show off her nose, and let her hair get even frizzier than it was naturally.
Well, and then the press, though, responded rather viciously, though. They called her Skeleton Sarah. They criticized her for being, I'm seeing here, as you quote in your book, for being a lawless woman who did nothing to hide her quote-unquote defect. I mean, they were harsh.
I think actually they were very harsh, I think in part because over and over again she circumvented their control and demonstrated that, you know, she was performing live. So yeah, she could go straight to her public, and if they liked her, they liked her, and the press had to cover her because the public was so interested in her. I think in some ways the most telling cartoon that mocked her showed her as a broomstick, making fun of how skinny she was, rail thin. But the broomstick is sweeping up gold coins, and those gold coins are coins she's collecting because she was popular, she pleased the public, both with her talents and with her eccentricities.
So she had already, just in the few minutes that we've been discussing, you can tell that Sarah Bernhardt had talent, as you mentioned, success because she was popular, and notoriety, which today would seem to be obviously the playbook for fame, even in 2019. But what was it about her that allowed her or led her to so deftly use the media at that time? Because as you said, she was unafraid to push back on newspaper critics of her. She even wrote a story about a hot air balloon ride that she took, but she wrote the story from the perspective of a chair. That was on the hot air balloon. What was that all about?
I think that hot air balloon story was a story about her bid for freedom. I think, you know, she had, as you put it, talent, success, and notoriety. And to that, we should add a very canny intelligence that understood how celebrity culture worked in her moment, and a boldness about using that understanding. She was told by her theater producer that it was too much of a risk for her to take a hot air balloon ride. It was kind of a thing at the time. There was a big hot air balloon in a big park in Paris, and for money you could go and take a ride in it. And you could sail away and sail many miles outside of Paris. And he said, well, what if you don't get back in time to perform at the theater and I forbid you? And she said, I'm going to do it anyway. And when I went back and researched it, this dominated newspapers for weeks. The press was outraged that she took this hot air balloon ride. And what I mean about her canniness is instead of saying, oh, I upset people, I should apologize, she was like, I'm going to double down. People like this hot air balloon ride. I'm going to write a little book about it. And I think writing about from the point of view of the chair was her little joke about being an object. When you're a celebrity, you are turned constantly into an object. And I think she thought, what would it be like to actually be an object and see the world as an object, like a chair?
Yeah. So you also write briefly about how once she allowed herself to be photographed sleeping in a coffin.
Yes. I think it may well be the first example of someone being photographed in their bedroom and asleep. So, you know, actors for a long time were only depicted in the costumes they wore for their roles. And then in the late 18th century, they began to be shown wearing ordinary clothes, you know, being themselves, quote unquote, and being shown maybe in their dining room. She took this one step further. I think what she was saying was, you want to see me exposed? You want to know all about my private life? Here we go. Here I am sleeping in my bedroom. But I don't sleep like other people. I sleep in a coffin. And, you know, to be a celebrity, you have to know how to turn yourself into good copy.
Right.
You have to make yourself into a story that interests and excites people because it's unusual and can be easily reproduced. And I think by having herself photographed sleeping in a coffin, it was a very economical way of showing I'm not like other people. I'm more interesting than other people.
I mean, one way to look at this from our perspective here in 2019 is here's a woman in the 19th century who had total control over her brand, right? And she, in a sense, by allowing the media in the manner that she wanted, partially controlled the narrative about her amongst her fans and amongst the public. Had anyone done it quite to the extent that Sarah Bernhardt did before she came onto the scene?
I think that she was historically positioned to control her brand in a way that other figures had not been. So you have examples of people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau or the poet Lord Byron, mm-hmm. who wrote about themselves. They took control over their stories by writing, in Rousseau's case, his autobiography called The Confessions, and in Byron's case, autobiographical poems that made him famous. But both of them quickly lost full control over their fame. Rousseau wrote about his sexual fantasies, about being spanked by an adult woman, and then he complained because everyone was gossiping about him.
Well, it just goes to show, be careful what you put out there
yes,
in the public.
Exactly. See, he didn't understand that.
Well, Sharon Marcus, stand by for just a moment. Professor Marcus is author of the new book called The Drama of Celebrity, which takes us through the life of Sarah Bernhardt, a 19th century actress who may have created the playbook for celebrity culture. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Sharon Marcus. She's a professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, and she's written a fascinating new book called The Drama of Celebrity and how our current celebrity culture may have found its origins in the 19th century and specifically with the remarkable career of 19th century actress Sarah Bernhardt. And Professor Marcus, I just want to take a quick call right here. Let's go to Belinda, who's calling from Bangor, Maine. Belinda, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna and guests. Thank you so much. I wanted to make a comment and ask a question. The comment was, when I was in Paris, I actually kind of lied my way down into the deep archives of the Library of Paris because I wanted to see photographs of Renée Vivien and Natalie Barney, but I ended up looking at the most beautiful photographs taken of Sarah Bernhardt. And she was in costume. It was a medieval costume. And they were kind of photographs that you might have for a marquee or that she might autograph mm-hmm. and give away to friends. And they were, I've never seen anything so beautiful. The photography was outstanding. And she was gorgeous. I mean, I had always thought she was quite homely. But when I looked at those photographs, I couldn't believe my eyes. Her hair was very long, and she held it out to the right and to the left with her hands and stared deeply into the camera. And it was absolutely, it was charismatic. I was mm-hmm. so pleased
yeah.
that I was able to do that.
And Belinda, what's your question?
My question is, Yeah. Wasn't it Sarah Bernhardt who claimed the body of Mata Hari after she was executed?
No. No, one of the great things about being a celebrity is that a lot of stories collect around them. I actually have never heard that one, which is one of the reasons I can say it's not something that happened, because if it had happened, I would have seen many newspaper stories about it. But it makes sense that they'd be connected. They were both compelling, enigmatic, charismatic women who defied convention.
Hmm. So, Professor Marcus, let me ask you, and Belinda, thank you so much for your call, by the way, and that description of Sarah Bernhardt and her penetrating stare into the cameras is quite something. But what is it that Sarah Bernhardt did? We're talking about her as someone who kind of created the playbook for celebrity culture that's with us to this day, even as technology has changed. So, you know, what are the parts of that playbook that Sarah Bernhardt so brilliantly brought together in her career?
I think Belinda just captured one of them really effectively. She had a command, Sarah Bernhardt had a command over her voice and her body, her image, her brand, that was charismatic and mesmerizing. And, you know, some people command attention by being repugnant. Some people command attention by being really beautiful and appealing. Some people do both. I think Sarah Bernhardt was someone who did both. She knew how to be frightening if she needed to be. Of course, different people reacted to her differently. So I think the first thing that she did in creating a modern playbook for celebrity is point to the importance of having a command over your voice, your body, your face, your appearance. Know how to turn it into the media of the day. So the second thing she did was really master the media of her day: photography, phonography, film, the press interview. And she wasn't afraid of controversy. I think that we have a tendency sometimes to think that celebrities are or should be role models. But in fact, celebrities, even when they are role models for some, are almost always negative models for others. And she was Sarah Bernhardt was never afraid of defying convention, of getting people upset. She was a single mother. She insisted on being introduced at parties as Miss Bernhardt when she brought her son, so that no one would think she was trying to pass as a married woman who had a child. And I think that another thing that was true about the playbook for modern celebrity, which is a very, very, very competitive field, is something we often forget. Most celebrities are very, very, very good at least one thing, and often at many things. Sarah Bernhardt was a superb actress. She was able to travel around the world performing exclusively in French in countries where often most of the people in the audience had no idea what she was saying, and still fascinate everybody with her ability to bring these roles to life. And she was also really good at attracting attention. And I think most celebrities minimally have to be good at attracting and holding attention, but they're usually quite good at other things as well.
So what does that mean for us today when a lot of people look at, YouTube stars or social media stars and say, well, they're famous just for being famous? That the core talent you're talking about isn't there.
I would say two things about that. It's not easy to be famous for being famous. If it were easy to be famous for being famous, if it were easy to just be good at being a celebrity and nothing else, we'd have even more celebrities than we have. And I think it's also interesting to look at how the word celebrity has changed over time. It first became common in the 1830s and 40s. And when I went and tried to go back in time and see how were people using this word in the 19th century, I assumed I'd find lots of examples of female ballet dancers and courtesans and actors, you know, performers. Like, that's the default kind of celebrity we think of today, especially when we think of, they don't really have that much talent. They're just famous for being famous. Instead, what I found was that in the 19th century, the majority of the people called celebrities were men, and they were men known, celebrated for worthy deeds. They were ministers, inventors, politicians. Abraham Lincoln, if you find a 19th century book called Celebrities of the Day, the people in it will be Mark Twain, Abraham Lincoln, the Pope. There's a book called Celebrities at Home, and there's a feature about the Pope. His home is the Vatican. The shift happened in the 20th century when more and more women became celebrities. The rise of film, TV, radio, recorded music. And as celebrity became more and more democratic, and as women came to dominate who we thought of when we thought of a celebrity, all of a sudden the term became much more pejorative and dismissive and trivialized. Now, I'm not going to say that what people who are people on YouTube putting on makeup are as important as Abraham Lincoln, but they're all good at something. And I think that as a society, we, the public, like judging people and we like evaluating them. And I do think that all celebrity, even the most trivial, meaningless kinds, first of all, what's meaningless to one person is very meaningful to another. But everyone has something that they can think of where they say, ugh, that celebrity, that's just nonsense. Even the nonsense celebrities are very, very good at the nonsense they're producing.
Okay,
and
so
that nonsense matters to someone.
So you got to be good at something. I hear you on that. But about this maintenance of fan goodwill, because that's a big part of what you write as well, that we all have a role here to play. It's not just the celebrity, him or herself. It's not just the media, and it's not just fans. There's a dynamic between the three. But, there are many examples we can think of from the 19th century where ultimately public opinion turned against them. I'll just give Oscar Wilde as an example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously,
mm-hmm.
brilliant, flamboyant, very much in the public eye, but he also ended up spending 2 years in jail for quote-unquote gross indecency.
So celebrity has always included notoriety, and there's, I think, no implication that celebrity always implies approval. I think the way celebrity works, and it's already there in what you're saying, is that celebrity engages publics in media that give information about these figures in the public eye, and we are asked to decide. We can approve of them. We can disapprove of them. We can decide to ignore them. If people aren't interested in someone controversial or exemplary, that person doesn't become a celebrity. It's our interest that sustains them. And yes, celebrities have different kinds of arcs. Some of them decline into, who knows who they are when they're 80. Some of them go from being at the top of the world to being put in jail, justly or unjustly. And all of that contributes, however, to their fame and their renown.
Mm-hmm.
Celebrity can be positive, it can be negative, but it just means that you're being talked about.
Yeah.
And Oscar Wilde was certainly more talked about after he went on trial than he had ever been before.
So there's no such thing as bad publicity issue there, but
right.
But you also write about, okay, so the flip side of that is you also write about very early in the book about an issue of Life magazine that featured a Catherine Spack on the cover. I'm seeing it here, 1966.
Mm-hmm.
And you accurately write, Catherine who? Right? Because later on in that same issue of Life magazine, there's a picture of Catherine Deneuve, which is the Catherine of
yes.
the 60s that everybody heard.
A much smaller picture.
Exactly. So what does the tale of Catherine Spack have to tell us? She who appeared on the cover of Life and no one remembers half a century later.
So it's a really good example of why the idea of being famous for being famous is catchy but reductive. A bit like what it accuses celebrity of being. When Daniel Boorstin came up with a version of the phrase celebrities are just famous for being famous in his famous book called The Image, what he was saying is that celebrities are just created by the media. The media saturates us with images of someone, puts them on the cover of Life magazine, and that's what makes a celebrity. And we're all being manipulated. We don't have any agency or choice. There's no evaluation going on. You know, you're just pummeled with these images, and that person becomes a star for no good reason. I think the Catherine Spack image is one good example for demonstrating that that's just not true. She was picked out of a bunch of young European starlets to be on the cover of Life magazine. Big break. She actually had a long career as a singer and actor, but she never became famous, and just being put on the cover of Life magazine wasn't enough. And then you have Catherine Deneuve, who wasn't given that prominence in that particular story, but she became much more famous, no doubt because she was probably more talented, more beautiful, maybe more in the right place at the right time, maybe made better choices about her publicists. And when I looked at magazines from the 1940s, film magazines, film fan magazines like Photoplay, I'd always find people I'd heard of, people who became very famous. I would also find people like Jeff Lynne, who for a couple of months in the 1940s was getting all kinds of feature stories written about him. Good-looking enough guy, made some interesting movies, never became a star. Media saturation is not enough. I think part of what makes celebrity compelling to people is that it's actually impossible to predict fully who will become a star. Yes, they're probably very talented and good at what they do, but because it's a dynamic that involves the interplay of the stars themselves, the public's decisions, and the publics are pretty diverse and fickle, and what happens in the media, it's really impossible to predict with accuracy who will become a star, who will stay a star, how their stardom will play itself out. And that unpredictability is part of what makes celebrity interesting to observe.
Mm. Well, let's just take a moment to listen to the voices of some modern-day celebrities. This is from a 2011 Barbara Walters interview of some of the women in the Kardashian family, Kim, Khloe, Kris, and Kourtney. This was during Barbara Walters' annual 10 Most Fascinating People special.
You are all often described as famous for being famous. You don't really act. You don't sing. You don't dance. You don't have any, forgive me, any talent.
But we're still entertaining people. I think it's more of a challenge for you to go on a reality show and get people to fall in love with you for being you. So there is definitely a lot more pressure, I think, to be famous for being ourselves than to play a character.
But I don't think we disagree.
Like, none of us think we have talents. Like, none of us think we could sing or act.
That's Kim and Khloe Kardashian speaking to Barbara Walters in 2011. Sharon Marcus, just respond to what the Kardashians said there briefly. Is it harder to be on a reality TV show and be famous for being yourself?
So I started this project before the Kardashians got famous. And of course, as I worked on it, I got asked about them all the time. And so I had to go research them because I'm an older person. And so they're not exactly in my demographic. And I just love them. Listen to them talk. They're fast on their feet. They're good rhetoricians. They knew not to try to defend themselves in a way that would be implausible. They're quite self-aware. And they are indeed correct. It is quite challenging for them to capture the attention of a bunch of people when they don't sing incredibly well, dance beautifully, act in compelling dramas and stories. What they have always been very good at is being extremely attractive and in a way that is both photogenic and telegenic, being quick on their feet, but also always sounding, I think, quite poised, and at emotional drama, which is what reality TV is about and what family is about for them. And they do all of those things really well. And then, of course, they are consummate businesswomen. They knew how to leverage all of that and turn it into products and brands. They were early adapters of social media. I am probably the least surprised person in the world that Kim Kardashian has turned to political causes and is studying law, because I never made the mistake of thinking that somebody who was really pretty and good at reality TV must be stupid. Mm. On the contrary.
Well, Sharon Marcus, professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. Her latest book is The Drama of Celebrity. Professor Marcus, stand by for just a second, because I want to bring into the conversation now Radhika Jones. She joins us from New York, and she is editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. Radhika Jones, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm really glad you could join us today, and thank you so very much. Because you've recently been thinking a lot about Vanity Fair and its role in celebrity culture. I mean, you were recently quoted as asking about the magazine's role in the celebrity industrial complex. Tell me more about that.
Well, yes, I first of all, I wanted to say to Sharon that I love the book, and perhaps it's not surprising that the magazine that I edit takes its name from a 19th century novel,
exactly.
Because there are, of course, great roots of the concept of celebrity there for us as well, even though there's something that can feel very modern about it, right? So, you know, the modern incarnation of Vanity Fair really took off in the 1980s under the editorship of Tina Brown. And one of the covers that really put her on the map early on was something you might call a crossover cover. It wasn't a movie star or an actress. It was a cover of Ronald and Nancy Reagan.
Right.
They were in the White House. If you remember back in those more innocent times, everybody was shocked that an actor was the president. Of course, he had had political experience.
Radhika, I'm going to have to just tell you to hold that thought for a second because we do have to take a very quick break, but we will be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the 19th century origins of modern day celebrity culture. And I'm joined today by Sharon Marcus. She's a professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. And her latest book is The Drama of Celebrity. Radhika Jones also joins us. She's with us from New York as well. She's the editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. We want to hear your thoughts on modern-day celebrity culture, about the fact that maybe the tenets of what makes a star have been with us for more than 150 years. Radhika, I'm so sorry that I had to interrupt you there before the break, but you were telling us about that breakthrough Vanity Fair cover featuring Ronald and Nancy Reagan from the 80s, and why was that so pivotal?
Yes, so so they were photographed dancing, and you know that they had already been credited or blamed, whichever side you were on, with bringing a sense of glamour and celebrity to the White House. People were sort of unsure about whether that kind of celebrity belonged there, and their appearance on the cover of Vanity Fair kind of vaulted the magazine into the public consciousness as a place where questions of celebrity, as it intersects with like core American institutions, would start to be posed. And if not resolved, then at least interrogated. And this went on with sort of iconic covers that you might remember from the 80s and 90s, like Demi Moore, naked and pregnant on the cover, which really brought to the public attention the question of, you know, celebrity through maternity and through the body of a woman and what that signifies. So it was something that was very interesting to me to think about archivally and in the present. You know, how does that attention to celebrity translate, and how do you move the needle in terms of a public conversation about what celebrity and fame are and where they are and where they show up? And how we talk about them.
So to that point, let's talk about for a second another recent Vanity Fair cover that did have an impact, perhaps not the one that the subject of the cover was hoping for. And I'm thinking of when Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke appeared on the cover of Vanity Fair. Later on, he went on The View in May to talk about the picture, because people might remember that on the cover of the magazine, you saw Beto O'Rourke, and then the text from the interview that he gave, which included the statement, quote, "I want to be in it, man. I was just born to be in it," meaning the president of the United States. So here's how The View's Joy Behar talked to O'Rourke about this.
Would you say those are mistakes, being on the cover of Vanity Fair?
Yeah, so Megan,
it looks elitist. What? What's
yeah, it? Yeah. I think it reinforces that perception of privilege, and that headline that said I was born to be in this. In the article, was attempting to say that I felt that my calling was in public service. No one is born to be president of the United States of America, least of all me.
Radhika Jones, let me ask you, I mean, in this day and age where social media is such a powerful force, and we have the atomization of the rest of the media as well, The fact that Beto O'Rourke really was set back by what was on the cover of Vanity Fair, well, what does that tell you about the power of magazines like yours to shape public perception of political celebrities to this day?
I mean, the power still exists, to be sure. I think, you know, it's interesting to think, I mean, it's just a few months ago, can feel like ancient history with the pace of news at the moment, but Beto O'Rourke was, you know, he had run such a galvanizing race in Texas, and there was a lot of interest in his potential candidacy, and he was talking about a call to public service, those kinds of statements in this day and age are very easy. They're sort of easily interpreted on a number of different levels, and I think that is what happened there. But I think for us, it was a reminder that a magazine cover, even in the era of social media, when people really can set their own message and amplify it in ways that were not possible even 20 years ago, let alone 100 years ago, you know, the role of the media, the role of distribution platforms, including social media, in terms of how they can help amplify messages, is still very significant.
Right. So Sharon Marcus, jump in here. I mean, first of all, just let's stick with the Beto O'Rourke example. What did O'Rourke fail to do that perhaps Bernhardt did so brilliantly 150 years ago?
Well, I'm going to take even a further step back and say these days it seems to me that often what print media have to do is follow social media. So you have some often are reporting on social media, and it's always been the task of journalists to follow what people are interested in, but take a more critical perspective on it. And I think in this case, Vanity Fair was really doing journalism at its best. Here's a candidate who's becoming a front runner, put him on the cover, and, you know, ask him some questions that give him a little room to either do well or do badly, and don't cover for him if he gives an answer that can be misinterpreted or can be interpreted lots of different ways. I think, you know, we have a very crowded field of Democratic candidates, and the press is going to be one way that we winnow out those who are able to withstand the pressures of being in the public eye. So Beto O'Rourke didn't think about how everything that someone says these days can be taken out of context, and how every quote has to be treated as a potential soundbite that is going to go viral. Sarah Bernhardt didn't quite have to contend with that, but Sarah Bernhardt also wasn't running for president. So, you know, if we can, it's unfortunately, in some ways, again, fortunately, the case that the Democratic candidate is probably going to have to be different from Donald Trump, who has created a situation where he can be monstrous, inappropriate, insulting, racist, misogynist, and that's what people expect of him. So a lot of people dislike that he does those things, but it's not going to hurt his image because that is his image. Beto O'Rourke and anyone who runs against Trump probably has to be more careful about that, and that's what he failed to do. Sarah Bernhardt had an image where she could be good and bad, and so it wasn't as important for her to be careful about her every step.
Let me then ask you both, and Radhika, I'll start with you, because in mentioning President Trump here, I think it's indisputable that he is a master of this media age. Indisputable. And of course, many people think that that's part of the what they see as the problem. But I guess that makes me wonder, we shouldn't be sort of unquestioning in our celebration of celebrity culture, right? I mean, shouldn't we be all be asking ourselves, maybe we have to always ask ourselves, should we interrogate more forcefully those people that we choose to make celebrities or make stars? I mean, Radhika, as a major editor of a important magazine, like, do you think about that question? You must think about that question a lot.
I do think about it a lot. I think that, yes, we do have to interrogate what it is that makes people famous and why we care about them. As I think, as Sharon said earlier, you know, there have always been examples of, it's not as if everyone who is a celebrity has very particular talents or has some kind of moral standing or something, you know, where we think, oh, of course everyone looks up to that person. I mean, there's always been, celebrity has always been twinned with notoriety, and it's not necessarily about a statement of values. But I think in a lot of different ways, we are thinking differently now about celebrity and the power that it yields. I mean, in my line of work, of course, we spend a lot of time thinking about Hollywood and the changes in Hollywood, and we've seen stories over the last couple of years, starting with the news about Harvey Weinstein and on, that help us to understand that some of our assumptions about even who could be famous in Hollywood are no longer necessarily the case, because the values of consumers and the values of fans are shifting, and aspirations about celebrity and fame shift as well. When you have different forms and different paths to fame, like reality television, for example, or social media or YouTube or what have you. So we think about it in all sorts of complicated ways. Yeah. It does, of course, cross over into politics. And I think that the more thoughtful we can be about what celebrity even means in 2019 and beyond, the better off we are.
Okay. So, Sharon Marcus, let me turn back to you there. First of all, actually, Radhika asked a really compelling question there. I mean, what do you think celebrity means in 2019?
Well, let me go back to what you were saying originally and just say we should never be unquestioningly approving or celebrating of anything, and certainly not of celebrity culture. But I would also say that for every politician who has used the media for what many people think is ill, there is a politician who has used new media to great ends. Franklin Delano Roosevelt used the radio to unite the country during the Great Depression by creating the concept of the fireside chat. John F. Kennedy had Frank Sinatra campaigning for him. How you feel about any of those things will depend a lot on whether you identify with the party of that president. But I think it's probably a mistake to condemn all of celebrity culture because at a given moment it brought a figure you don't approve of into power, or to celebrate it because at a given moment it brought someone you really love into power. I think what's important is to remember, and I think this is truer in 2019 than it has ever been, that each of us helps to make and unmake celebrity culture. And then we have a decision to make. Is the best way to use our power to ignore those that we disapprove of? Because, of course, paying attention to people, even to criticize them, increases their celebrity. That's the there is no bad publicity problem.
Yeah.
Or is it our obligation as citizens to weigh in and say, I know I'm adding to the feeding frenzy by commenting, but I really think that what so-and-so said is wrong. And it's hard to ever know what the effect will be, but I think it all comes down to realizing that celebrity culture doesn't exist without us, and we therefore have a responsibility to be thoughtful about
right.
how we engage with it.
Well, I want to see if I can get at least one or two calls here before we run out of time here. So let's go to Stephen, who's calling from Bristol, Tennessee. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi. I was really flabbergasted that your guest was praising the Kardashians. Kim Kardashian got started doing a cheap porn flick, and though they have taken society and made money from that, and I don't blame them for that, to me, they're not good role models at all. I mean, they show up not breaking sexist stereotypes that we have across America, just in their image and how they show up and how they look. And then consumerism, I think they've compounded that with young people all about what they're buying
right.
and how they physically look, as opposed to what's on the inside, and I don't think they're good role models at all.
Well, Stephen, thank you for your call, and that was Sharon Marcus, who I was talking about the Kardashians with a little earlier. Sharon, would you like to respond to Stephen?
Well, I think you're entitled to that opinion for sure, and that would definitely be a good conversation to have with one's kids about who they give their attention to and what that means they're valuing. But I also think we live in a society that tells women that really all that matters is their appearance and then punishes them for paying attention to their appearance. We live in a society that's built around buying and selling things. And then there's some people that when they sell things, we say, oh, you're just promoting consumerism. Other people, we make them into CEOs of companies and give them huge, huge, huge salaries. So I think it ends up being a little more complicated when we decide that appearances do and don't matter, when we decide that consumerism is and isn't bad. And I certainly would not encourage anybody I know to make a porn movie, and I think that Kim Kardashian may have, you know, come to regret some of those decisions that she made. But I think it's also quite hypocritical in a lot of ways to fault women who go that route because they are just dealing with what society values most in women.
Well, Radhika Jones, we've just got a tiny bit of time left, and I wanted to circle back to where we started with you about you wondering about the celebrity industrial complex. Does that mean, the very fact that you're asking this question, does that mean that you're wondering if you should take Vanity Fair in a different direction now?
Well, I think ultimately, we are still very much a magazine that focuses on celebrity. What I would emphasize there, as I think Sharon has said too, is that that doesn't mean that we simply accept it on its face. I think a lot of the people we talk to, even the people who are on our covers, are themselves, you know, curious and innovative about the ways that they can build a following or build their or use their talents toward other ends. Like, they are exploring different ways to be a celebrity in the current era because it is different from how it used to be, because they have more tools at their disposal. So in a way, it doesn't, to me at least, it doesn't necessitate a turning inside out of the of the overall endeavor. It just means asking questions and being very open-minded and, I think, intellectually curious and rigorous about what we're talking about when we talk to celebrities, when we talk about celebrities, when we think about what their power is in this culture and globally.
Well, Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sharon Marcus, I have one last question for you in the 30 seconds that we have left to get us back to Sarah Bernhardt. Her light didn't fade, even in her older years. What ended up happening to her?
She ended up becoming a film director, and she ended up having her leg amputated because of an injury she'd sustained in a stage stunt years before. And after her leg was amputated, she undertook one last tour of the United States, performing in circus tents, and nothing stopped her. She was really unstoppable.
And even when she died, it was news around the world, wasn't it?
Dominated headlines for weeks.
Well, Sharon Marcus, professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. Her latest book is The Drama of Celebrity. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Professor Marcus, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Meghna. This was fantastic.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.